Hello, this is Daniel Jacob.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, They Just Burned All the Goodwill. This week's show is sponsored by NS Screencast and PDF Pen. Well, Manton Reese, my friend, we are in a very bad place because we, as longtime listeners to the show will know, are both investors in this little upstart computer company called Apple. All the glory days are over now. It, you know, used to be like sky's the limit. This thing's going out of control. It's up to like $125 a share earlier, like last year. Now it's like hovering around $96 a share. Any Apple employees listening? Oh boy. Pour yourselves a drink. Your modest, your average to below average Silicon Valley salary is suddenly looking like it's not going to cut it.
They were always right all these years. They're doomed. The company's doomed.
They were just about 16 years early when they proclaimed the death of Apple.
By the way, disclaimer, not investment advice. Anything we say
can and will be used against you.
But sell everything. Sell everything.
Yeah, I'm not too worried. I am a longtime investor in Apple, and I would be lying if it doesn't bum me out a little bit. If I said it doesn't bum me out a little bit when I look at the stock price and I see it down so much. But over the years, I've kind of like grown into that attitude. I think you should have. You know, it's maybe this is a sign of maturity, dare I say it, Manton. But you know, when you're younger, people say, don't buy stocks. And they say, only buy mutual funds. And then they say, okay, buy a stock if you have the money to spare, but you have to be willing to completely lose it. And they say, okay, buy the stock if you have the money to spare, but you have to be willing to sit on it for like 20 years because you can't time the market. And somehow I got that message to some extent because lo and behold, it's been 20 years.
Nice. Well, Apple stock, if you look over the last 20 years, was a really great investment.
It was a pretty lucky break. I mean, I did end up selling quite a bit over the years to supplement my income when I had quit to go back to school. And, you know, here and there, you just run out of money. And then, hey, it's nice to have that that stock. But if you don't get pushed to sell, I think the question on many people's minds is this the end of the road for Apple stock? Is it going to just be going down further and further and further now? Sell it before it dives. And as Manton said, of course, we are not offering financial advice. But just as a curiosity, before the show, Manton and I were both talking about this blog post we saw that tried to put some perspective on this by extrapolating from Apple's cash gains what, you know, how long it would take before the company would literally be worth more than its stock valuation if the stock stayed at, say, $96 a share. I don't have it handy, Manton. It's not right here, but it was a pretty good reminder that it doesn't really matter how much at some point, you know, people are right, you know, of course, that the stock market is illogical. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense and it goes up and down against common sense. But at some point, you just can't have companies that are worth more in stock valuation than they have cash on hand, right? I mean, yeah. Please tell me that's true.
It's such a weird company to follow too, because we're used to the old Apple. I still think about them not as the company that posts the highest quarter in, you know, the history of the world. Right. I still think about them in a different sense, but they're so big. I honestly wish they were privately held company often, because I just feel like that's a distraction.
Well, I mean, there's this famous t-shirt we had at Apple that was, I was there when the comeback began.
Mm-hmm. It's good.
And
good.
I think if I remember, comeback was celebrated when the company, like probably through some like tricky working of the numbers on the books, was able to, for the first quarter in like many, many quarters, post like a $30 million profit. And they're like, see, we're badass money making machines.
30 million. How cute. By
30 million
standards.
I know. I'd still like to make 30 million, but for Apple, it wouldn't really cut it.
Yeah. You know, I've been listening and kind of following what Jason Snell seems to say. And I don't know. I don't actually know if he owns stock. And we were kind of joking that we both have some. I don't have that much. And of course, I joked about selling, but I'm not going to, right? So I've just got to hold on to it because, again, even just over the last few years, I haven't had it as long as you have, but even just the last few years, I mean, it's been kind of crazy. So why not hold on to it? Also, I like investing, even though I barely have anything in the stock market. I like picking companies that I really believe in. Of course, I still really believe in Apple. But Jason had a post over at Macworld today about kind of iPad sales. And I think he made a point, I don't know if it was in this post or something on the Upgrade podcast, but his point was something about, if you think about the iPod, you know, it was huge and it got really big. And a lot of Apple's success kind of rode on some of that, you know, how popular and mainstream the iPod became. But then it died down. And of course, now it's a real small amount of their sales. And so you could say, well, what about the phone? What if the same thing happens to the iPhone? What if this is the top and it's just going to fall down from here and this is the end of the world for Apple? But the point he made is that it's not like that at all, because as far as we can tell, there's nothing on the horizon that's going to replace and obsolete the smartphone.
Yeah.
Smartphone is here to stay probably for a long time. So it's not like the iPod at all, where you couldn't justify buying an iPod anymore because you had all that functionality more on your phone in your pocket all the time. And so it's hard for me to imagine how, even if sales are not going to keep growing at the rate that Wall Street would love them to grow at, they're still going to be selling an unbelievably large amount of iPhones every quarter.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, how long would it take and how many mistakes would it take, or how much upset, you know, disruption, quote unquote, from another company or another technology would it take for Apple, coming off of a quarter when they made, I think it was $20 billion? No, that can't be right.
It could be.
It could be. Yeah, I mean, the numbers are impossible to grapple with. You're right, it could be, because now I think they have over $200 billion globally in cash. I think it was something like $20 billion in profit. And you think, like, okay, that's the high point. What does it go to? It doesn't go to 30 million next quarter. You know, they're not going to, I mean, I could always be wrong, of course, but it doesn't strike me as likely that a company that has been increasingly making huge amounts of cash, and let's say that this is the apex and they make $20 billion in a quarter, I don't think they're going to make 30 million next year. And I don't think they're even going to make 10 billion, right? It's probably going to be, if it doesn't meet the same amount, what do they make, like 15 billion?
I have no idea. I just kind of gloss over the numbers and the charts because I'm not the CFO at Apple. I don't really care that much as long as they're turning out quality products. But they seem to have it down. Like they know what they're doing. And also they keep positioning themselves to spread, you know, more over other product lines, introducing completely brand new products like the watch and the TV. And then doing things like not putting everything in the September event, I think is really smart. I mean, I think there is too much focus on that huge quarter for the holidays. Like spread it around. And so, I mean, even if I wasn't really excited about the it's actually happening 4-inch iPhone 5SE that's coming up in just a month or so, I think I would respect the timing and the idea of we're going to introduce a lot of different kinds of products at different times throughout the year. So it's we're not all just our whole company is bet on the brand new flagship iPhone and that's it.
Well, I guess the bigger picture, like I would like to just backpedal and say, I don't know, maybe they will make $30 million next quarter. It could fluctuate, I guess, weirdly, but the specific numbers aside, it's a money-making machine right now. Like Apple has a money-making machine, and the number of things I think that would have to go wrong for that money-making machine to dry up quickly. It's kind of like a comparison I made once in a talk I gave about being an indie software developer. It can be a real drag, like when you're powering up the company, getting the software started, getting recognition, you start to make a little money, and then it takes like weeks, months, maybe years before you're making like a living at your software. But then the trade-off to that is it takes, you know, weeks, months, and years for the dissipation, you know, for the money to stop rolling in too. Mm-hmm. Cause you get to a certain point, let's not use me as an example, cause I'm not as successful as all that, but let's take somebody like Panic, right? If Panic just like checks out tomorrow and doesn't, you know, nobody comes to work.
They start making video games or something.
They start making video games. No, they just like, you know, they take one of their annual, you know, company-wide Hawaii vacations, and they just decide to stay for the year, right? And they don't even do customer support. They throw all caution to the wind. I guarantee you a year later, after a year of neglect, Panic is still making more money than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, there's just, this stuff takes a little, this is like a, it's like a big ship. It takes a little while to slow down. So, I don't know. Yeah, I just, maybe that makes me a little too Pollyanna about Apple. But the other thing, and we won't make this the whole stock show, but the other thing that strikes me is that in a way, as an investor in Apple, it's kind of lucky that they're riding so close to the cash valuation, because it, to my mind at least, and for the same reasons as that blog article that we'll link to cite, there's not as much risk of downside, because it's not one of those things where, like, if I was invested in Facebook, I would be wondering, like, okay, because Facebook is one of those companies where it's like the PDE, the price to earnings, is like way up there, and it's, the price is high on the stock because everybody anticipates them being a huge part of the future, and it's not because so much, although they had apparently good earnings and stuff, but it's not so much on the current value of the company. And I would be more nervous about that. I'd be like, anything can happen, right? You get the next like MySpace killer that comes out and boom, no more company.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, like I said, the same kind of disruption is possible for Apple, but just seems to me like they're going to be selling quite a few more iPhones, quite a few more iPads, quite a few more Macs. And boy, this will be the episode that goes down in history when Apple turns out to go out of business next year.
Right. There's some comfort in the fact that that's just not possible. Like, that you can't even make up a crazy scenario that would have them go out of business within the next, I would say, 10 to 15 years. It would be extremely difficult. I don't think Tim Cook could, even trying hard, I don't think he could ruin the company within 10 or 15 years, just because of the amount of cash and the amount of momentum and everything that they have.
I don't know if you can print checks that fast. Like, if he just started sending out checks, like $1 million checks.
Yeah.
I guess it would happen pretty fast.
It must be feeling pretty good. I mean, they should be feeling confident, right? But at the same time, because they're Apple and because they have the history of having some really difficult times that you and I remember, they are great about, we're not going to slow down. We're not going to stop innovating. We're not going to stop thinking about whatever crazy product we might need to come up with that, you know, again, the iPhone's not going anywhere, but we're going to keep coming up with new ideas just in case there is something out there. We don't want our competitors to be there first.
I mean, they have enough money now and enough, like, you know, you hear these now speculation about whether they're working on the VR market. Right, which on the face of it sounds like, oh, please give me a break. Like, I don't want to.
I'd rather they work on a car than the VR market.
Yeah, on the face of it, but just to complete that thought, I have to step back and think. You know, VR is a very broad technology category, and so the part of me that says, "Oh, brother," is the part that, you know, sort of imagines like people like hooked up like in Wall-E or something to just like food tubes and, you know, sitting back and never living a normal life again. And this sort of negative connotations of a totally virtual reality. But of course, take a step back and it's like, oh no, VR is just like this category of technologies that, I think it was on the talk show with Matthew Panzerino and John Gruber. I think they, you know, summed it up and said, it's just a screen, you know, like, it's a different kind of monitor. Hmm. It's a monitor that wraps around your eyes. And
sounds terrible to me.
It does in a sense. Here's a funny thing. In that, using that metaphor, VR headset is like headphones are to audio, right? Uh-huh. It's completely immersive environment of artificial sound.
Hmm.
I think if I get away from my sort of, you know, bias against visual blockout, I mean, let's break it down a little bit. Like when you go to the movies and they shut down all the black, shut down the lights and make the whole room black except for the big screen, that's an environment where you're choosing to live in a virtual reality, right? Like you really don't want to see anything outside of the screen except for maybe your popcorn or something. I guess in that sense, like I'm trying to remind myself that if Apple gets into VR, it's a poor assumption to assume that they would get into it on the terms that everybody else is getting into it. You know, it's like it's a poor assumption that, just like it was a poor assumption that if Apple made a wearable, it would be like a Google Glass competitor.
That's a good point. Yeah, as you say that, though, I wonder if maybe it is related to what everyone else is getting into VR for, which is games. Because they do want to have the Apple TV be a good gaming platform. And I don't really play games on it much other than kind of fiddling around when it first came out. But I was reminded about this because they have a new kind of marketing push for the Apple TV. And have you seen one of the TV ads for it? They're really good. No. If you haven't seen one, I just randomly saw one when watching TV a couple of days ago, because they kind of slowly introduce you to, you know, movies and then the interface, and then there's games on it too. And I've only seen the ad once, but it worked really well. And I noticed last weekend we went up to Dallas to see a musical, and we were just there one night. But I noticed that this huge Apple TV billboards, like huge, like all the way up like a skyscraper wall, you know, and then like these big, you know, whatever, like big billboards, not just your normal like side of the highway ones, but like really big ones. And then like several positioned like within a block from one another. So they seem to like really be pushing the Apple TV right now. And maybe the VR stuff, maybe it's related to that.
Yeah, I guess on the one hand, I'm like, oh, it's Apple, they'll do a good job. And on the other hand, I'm like, oh, Apple, like they're trying to do too many things. And they're not doing a great job on everything, you know. But I don't know, we kind of got off on a tangent there. But just to say, there are, I think what brought me into that was acknowledging that there are a lot of different side projects that Apple's doing because they can afford to, because they have the technological expertise on hand, and because they know that they're, you know, Apple's never been the kind of company that says, well, we got it figured out. We figured out if we make an iPhone, that's what's going to save the company. Or, you know, if we make an iPod, that's what's going to save the company. And that's what's going to bring us out of this rut. It's more like, well, we figured out that of the 20 things we made, this is the one that's actually going to get us out of the rut or whatever, you know, like they don't know. They're not like future. They can't tell the future. They try to make things and they see how they fly. And then if they fly well enough, they bring them to the public. And then even then, sometimes they don't fly well enough to actually stick around. But it kind of keeps the excitement in the company that even though it's a huge, successful money-making machine, Apple is like in the habit of fishing around for other huge successes. And I don't know, that still makes it a pretty interesting bet to me. Like, what are they going to come out with next? Car, VR, who knows? Okay, folks, we are happy to have back sponsoring the show this week our friends at NS Screencast. And NS Screencast, of course, is a series of short focused screencasts on iOS development. You get a new one every week. Now there are over 200 episodes, and as a member, you get access to all of them. They use a term called trickle learning. It's a great way to chip away at the iceberg of information you could want to learn about. You do it a little bit at a time, short videos. They're easy to digest, easy to process. And, you know, you can learn things using NS Screencast, whether you're new to iOS programming or whether you've been working on it for a long time. They got topics covered all across the spectrum. You can learn things about specific technologies or kind of just getting started, getting your feet wet. There's something there for everybody. And they recently launched a tvOS app, so you can watch from your couch. If you're feeling lazy, you can spend a few minutes, kick back on the couch, watch some NS screencasts, and come out of it being more educated, more professional, more ready to build great software. The good news is all of this is only $9 a month, or you can pay for a whole year up front for just $100 a year. They also, of course, have teams in mind. So if you work for a company, you want to get your whole team on board in a screencast, they have plans available for that as well. And you can use a coupon code. As a listener of Core Intuition, they have a special offer which will get you 30% off the first month. And you can learn more about NS Screencast, all the great videos they have, the membership plan, etc., at nsscreencast.com/coreint. Thanks so much to NS Screencast for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, you know, this is obviously a great way to get started. If you're new to iOS development, you want to like pick up, you know, how to learn Swift, how to build an app, how to learn some new part of UIKit or something. But it's also a great way to like just keep up to date with what's going on in new APIs. And since they're all so short, 10 or 15 minutes, I mean, I think you could just, you every week, you know, you spend 10 or 15 minutes, that's it. 10 minutes a week. And you're caught up to speed on some of these APIs that you may not use all the time in your current apps, but you're familiar with them. And then when you do need to use them, you've got that in the back of your head, like, oh yeah, I remember how to, you know, like, for example, some of the new ones had some stuff on table view customization, working with JSON, some WatchKit. It was a series on WatchKit. Like, even if you're not using this stuff right away, that's 10 minutes of time and you understand like the bigger picture. It's a great way to learn. And in some cases, it's a lot faster than kind of wading through like written documentation.
Yeah. You know, Manton, one more thing I just want to say about NS Screencast. If you're like me, you've got like this long list of WWDC videos to watch. And I do chip away at those here and there. But to be honest, it's a lot easier to chip away when your videos are 9 minutes to 20 minutes long and very focused, very designed for learning. So no knock on WWDC videos, but boy, this is a great alternative for you. Just want to dig into learning specific stuff quickly and efficiently. Thanks again. nsscreencast.com/coreint.
So Daniel, last week, the developer community got some big kind of bad news is what I called it on my blog post, in that Facebook is shutting down Parse. And, you know, there's been a lot of reactions, some good blog posts. I'm sure there's a bunch of tweets that I didn't even see about this. But whether you use Parse or not, I assume you haven't. And I assume, you know, a lot of people haven't. But whether you kind of think it's good or bad, there's no arguing that this is a really big deal. And I don't even think we know the full effects of this yet. And so it's only been, you know, less than a week.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about Parse, but actually, at that conference I spoke at in Amsterdam, the Do iOS conference, there was a Facebook engineer there from Parse. So I'll tell you one thing: I don't think Parse had any plans of shutting down as of November.
Right, and even so, the thing that I was struck by is even in December, a month ago, I think maybe just barely over a month before the announcement that they're shutting down, they were rolling out new features. Like they rolled out, you know, TVOS SDK. They completely redesigned their web dashboard for like managing your, you know, database data and dealing with that kind of stuff. Really nice redesign. I'd be surprised if most of the Parse team knew this was happening even a month ago.
That kind of makes it more depressing. It's like most people are interpreting it as, you know, how depressing for iOS developers in the world who depend upon this service. And there's also, of course, the angle of how depressing for the folks who, like, this was their passion. And we don't know exactly what went on, but just to say, like, ugh, you know, like, that sucks because...
Yeah.
That's how I summarize everything. Ugh, you know, that sucks.
Apple stock down. But, ugh. Parse ugh. Down. Ugh.
But yeah, you know, several people, I'm sure, within Facebook were working on this passionately, thrilled that they had probably thousands, definitely hundreds of customers.
I would say tens of thousands, actually. Yeah. I'd put it very high. Yeah.
Yeah. And you just get this is one of those situations where the corporate powers that be have different things in mind than the individuals or maybe even the lower level managers who are passionate about something. And you have to think that when Facebook acquired Parse, they were like, haha, this is it. This is our ticket into developer services and we're going to be a big name in developer stuff. And maybe they were looking at Twitter with their Fabric stuff. Maybe they were looking at, you know, Amazon with their, all their, you know, developer, you know, hosted services. But then at some point somebody says, nah, not going to happen. And the, comparison, cause it was so, it's a good comparison, I think, not only because it was timed around the same time, but also because I imagine the same level of low level passion for the product was the news from VMware, not that they were shutting down Fusion per se, but that they had, merely fired the entire team.
Oh, dear.
Did you hear about that?
I did,
So, and it's just like, I mean, both of those things sort of drive home that a couple messages. One is, this is the kind of stuff that will drive people to GPL. You know, it's like, what can you count on if you don't have the source code? And in the case of VMware, it's widely considered one of the, you know, the, I think most people consider it the best virtualization product, period. And if you run, if they're either not going to develop it anymore or not going to develop it to the same degree of with enthusiasm, where does that leave everybody who depends on it? And I think to Facebook's credit with Parse, and they don't think they did a good job of emphasizing this, at least to the, you know, the people who first like panickedly retweeted the news. They released, I think, everything from the server end to host your own Parse, basically. And I know, Manton, you're going to say, well, that's not trivial. And, you know, there's a reason people pay for this stuff. But I didn't look at the details too carefully. But what was interesting is Microsoft swooped in. And they're like, that's cool. We'll take Parse customers.
Right. It's a great opportunity for other people.
I mean, it is for any other company that has significant revenue or, you know, significant funding to be able to support that customer base and is still interested in the market. Like, you know, you could have seen Twitter doing something similar, I think, if Microsoft didn't, or maybe they will do it too. I don't know. But I guess it's just, you can't trust anybody. You got to just trust yourself. You got to do it yourself. If you want it done right, you got to do it yourself. I'm sure we can come up with some more, dismissive, idioms here.
Well, you know, as Charles Perry was saying on the Release Notes podcast this week, it's some people just don't want to do it themselves. Like there's, even if more and more people want to do it themselves, there's just some people that are just not going to want to deal with it. And it's not for lack of skills maybe or time. It's just they want to prioritize and focus on what they're either what they're good at or what they enjoy doing. And running servers isn't one of those things. Also, I think client work, a couple of people have brought this up. I think this is a big deal. And I'm saying that with a little experience now because I kind of ignored Parse for a few years. It looked really nice and everyone was saying, oh, it's great. And when Facebook acquired them, you know, they kind of changed the pricing a little bit. And it was even a better deal and really simple. And I kind of ignored it because I like to do, like, if I'm having data storage, like these core things, not kind of like analytics or, you know, kind of like, or push notifications even, or things that are kind of secondary, but like core, like I'm storing actual user data and syncing it. Like that core stuff I like to run myself. But just literally 2 or 3 months ago, I started on a client project and they needed some backend stuff. And I, not only did we start using Parse for it, I recommended it. Like I went to bat for these guys. I was like, you know, people have recommended it, Parse, it's solid. You know, we're going to be able to use it for free for like for this long based on, you know, how the app is going to scale up. And I thought it was great. And it's been around long enough where I didn't think it was about to go away. And I think there are a lot of people out there like that. Like they do work for someone else and they don't want to be in the long-term business of hosting server stuff for a client. So they say, no, just use this. You can pay with your credit card for the hosting. You know, it's going to keep running. I'm not going to need to maintain it for you. It's a really nice solution for client and kind of consulting work like that.
Yeah, it's funny. When this whole news came out, I thought it was interesting on Twitter. There was like this whole chorus of, well, what did you think was going to happen? Of course, I knew from day one when Facebook acquired it, it was going to get shut down. Well, the opposite interpretation is just as likely, I think, that...
Yeah.
Holy cow, this like startup with no, as far as I, you know, I don't know, but probably not a guaranteed, you know, profit future, mm-hmm. is acquired by a gigantic, enormous, like solid as any business can be really at this particular point in history, company. And my takeaway would be, it's not going anywhere. Facebook's behind it. You know?
Yeah, you can make arguments overtures. Either way, for sure.
Yeah, right.
Most companies fail, right? And most small companies have a hard time being like big players in terms of hosting and this kind of thing. So they might not have lasted even this long if they hadn't been acquired. There's no way to tell. It's easy to say in hindsight that, yeah, I was doomed. But
yeah,
I think there's something else to this. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about this, but in terms of how much goodwill did Facebook just completely burn to the ground? Because, for example, like every once in a while I get like recruiting emails from Facebook. I got one maybe a month or two ago from someone. And to their credit, the ones I've gotten have been really targeted and like really well put together. You know, like, hi, Manton. You know, I know you're doing your own thing at Riverfold Software, but just in case you're interested in joining our team, here's how happy everyone is in this picture at our campus. You know, but like not just spam. Like they put a little bit of work into this, right?
Yeah.
They just burned all the goodwill and all the hope that people – I think that people would have for that situation, because they had something that they were offering to developers. It was a solid service. It was well-designed, good API. They ripped it up. A lot of people are going to be scrambling. Now if they come around and they want to hire the best iOS developers, you know, there's going to – some of those developers are going to – in the back of their head, they're going to be like, yeah, don't like the way you did this. I don't like the way you handled this. You know, you just made $1 billion and then you pulled the rug out from under us. Don't have a good feeling about that. I don't really have a good feeling about working for you right now.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's a major problem. I think even if they were losing a little money on it, they probably should have just kept it going for that reason alone.
That's a very tricky question. You know, how do you decide when to shut something down? And there is more than just a literal financial cost. It's the sort of focus cost that we have as indies, and medium-sized businesses have it, and huge businesses like Facebook have it, where it's like, it's sometimes you get, you know, what we were talking earlier about Apple getting into like different, trying different things, you know, make a VR thing, make a, you know, a whatever, you know, they're in a games business now a little bit. And it's like everything you try and you make public, you're suddenly on the hook for disappointing somebody when you shut that down. I agree with you on one hand. And on the other hand, it's like, boy, I feel like a lot of us need to learn the lesson that we can't let sort of public expectation trump what we know is best for our business. And it makes me really curious, like whether the decision that was made within Facebook, which seems to be that Facebook shouldn't have a role as a general mobile development services provider, whether that decision was made, whether that was the right decision or not. I tend to agree with you that if they could have kept this going, it would be great for their PR. It might be worth it for their PR. Even if it's like a total loss, even if it's just like counted as PR funding, you know, just to be like part of that mobile development backbone.
Yeah. And it also helps, you know, they could work more features into Parse that kind of encourage people to build apps for the Facebook platform too, right? I mean, there's a lot they could do that has to have an indirect benefit. Mm-hmm. I think it's a classic like short-term, long-term thinking. You know, it's like short term, yeah, we're going to save some money and we can simplify our business. But long term, there's an impact and not a very good one in this case. Think about like some of Apple's parts of their business. I mean, you could pick a bunch of ones, but the first thing that came to mind was the thing that impacts developers the most, which is that we pay 30% to Apple, right? It's a lot, but business-wise, I mean, maybe Apple, what if they say, well, let's raise it to 35% that we're going to take, or 40%? Short term, you know, it's going to look a lot better for the services part of their chart, you know, that quarter when they're releasing revenue figures and stuff. But long term, it would be disaster, right? So you can't just look like, okay, short term, this is going to be helping our business. Like, how is this going to play out in 6 months and 12 months?
Well, it makes me wonder when I jumped to the conclusion that Facebook must not be interested in general developer tools. It makes me wonder, like, what's in store for Origami? You know, they're like visual prototyping tools.
Oh, right. Are you
familiar with that?
That's not even really a product, though. That's kind of like a, we open source something and we think it's pretty cool. We use it internally.
But it's in that same respect, it could be deemed a distraction too.
Mm-hmm.
It's something for them to support on one level or another. And I have to imagine when you're like, I mean, I wonder what the cost of Parse was. Was the cost so great that they had to say, like, this is not viable? Were they getting like Manton Reist out of business?
I'd be very surprised if the cost was very much compared to like the full scope of Facebook's thousands and thousands of servers.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised.
I mean, they're hosting like every teenager's photos from around the world on Instagram, right?
Right.
And then they're like, some developer data? Nah.
Yeah, and most apps that are using Parse, I think, probably have fairly small needs. And, you know, you can store images and things like that in it. In fact, I was for this client app, but it's pretty small scale. I'd be very surprised if it was really hurting them. And of course, it wasn't completely free. They had two tiers. They had free, which is good enough for most small apps, I think, even medium-sized apps. And then they had a paid, you know, version that was however many.
Right.
I don't know. It wasn't super cheap. It was probably I think it probably started at $100 a month or something like that. Don't recall. And it's probably not on their website anymore. But, you know, they were making some money from their bigger customers.
Yeah. Sort of reminds me of Yahoo with all the like stuff that they've famously shut down over the years, like stuff that people really loved, like Delicious. Remember for saving links.
Oh, yeah.
And just more recently, kind of a really must have been like a real niche product for nerds, but they shut down their Yahoo Pipes, these were both things where I was like, kind of in the same like PR goodwill category, like people are out there who love this, and can't you just keep it running in case it becomes huge? Like, you know, I mean, maybe at some point they have a better way of projecting it than I do, but I don't know. That seems comparable. It's like Parse was big enough that it had, you know, just judging from the reaction among developers, it was big enough that it had that group of people for whom probably any new project they created that had a data backend on the web, they would just automatically default to using Parse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd believe that.
And then you have to imagine that attitude grows over time if people continue to get good, you know, performance and behavior out of it. That's like exactly what Microsoft's looking for. So it's with their Azure stuff, right? It's the same kind of stuff that they want to provide to people. So I guess it's no surprise that they picked this up and are trying to run with it. But yeah, it's fascinating to me. Well, I guess why Facebook doesn't want to be in that game. And maybe in retrospect, we'll look back at it and think, oh, that was brilliant of Facebook to get out of that crappy developer tools game.
Okay, this week we're happy to have Smile Software back sponsoring the podcast. PDF Pen is your Swiss Army knife for PDF foo. It's got all the basics covered, such as filling and signing forms, making edits, highlighting, and OCRing. And you can go all the way with redaction, Word export, page numbering, and its fancy cousin Bates numbering. Even take it on the road with PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone. Are you a paperless office fan? Perfect. Don't print in fax, just fill and sign with PDF Pen and be on your way. Come see what PDF Pen can do for you at smilesoftware.com/coreint.
You know, Manton, I have been a PDF Pen user for a long, long time, and it really started to ramp up when I got my first kind of modern scanner. You know, like not a flatbed scanner, but the kind you put a big stack of paper in and it scans it. And it just eats that stuff up. And I have it set up so the scanner passes on afterwards to PDF Pen. let PDFpen use its fancy OCR to make it all into searchable stuff where I can consult it at any time. And then that paper, the diminishing amount of paper that comes into my life goes into PDFpen. I save it on my Mac, and then that paper goes to the recycling, and I just feel that much lighter, and everything's at my disposal. Wherever my computer is, wherever my access to the web is, I can get that stuff. And PDFpen is a robust app. It has been around a long time, like I said. We're at PDFpen 7 now, and they have a pro version and a regular version. The PDFpen 7 is $75, and PDFpen Pro 7 is $125. And adds features like interactive PDF forms, the ability to create PDFs directly from websites. You can export to Excel, PowerPoint, and PDF archive formats. And you can also edit OCR text and do really fast proofreading of your scanned documents with the Pro version. So there's something for everybody here. Like I said, I started with the scanning and just popping it into the OCR. Over the years, I have learned more and more about what this great app can do. They have a landing page that Manton mentioned. It's smilesoftware.com/coreint. If you go to that page, if you're just a tiny bit curious, go to that page. Check it out. It's not like a not like a do nothing page. You go there, you'll get a quick pitch about PDFpen and a video showing you some of the great features of this app. Definitely worth checking out. PDFpen and PDFpen Pro for the Mac are fully compatible with OS X El Capitan. This software is kept up to date. It's kept great. It's worth the money, and everybody should go check it out.
You know, Daniel, one of the sites I subscribe to is called The Sweet Setup, and it shows up in my RSS feed when they have something new. And their format is kind of like, we'll tell you about a couple options, and then we'll tell you the one that we love the most. And I just noticed last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, popped up in my RSS reader, the best PDF app for the Mac, PDFpen. And so you can check out that review, too. It goes through the highlights of PDFpen for Mac, and they love the app. Thanks again to Smile Software for sponsoring the show. Again, smilesoftware.com/coreint.
Okay, Manton, we've talked about Parse. We've talked about software you love, services you love, getting shut down. Maybe you have no hope. You can't do anything because you've got your favorite services shut down. But the good news actually is I think you can be defensive about this by being prepared for the possibility that you might need to change web services. And I know, Manton, between the two of us, you have used a lot more web services than I have. You've not only used more, you've provided them, you've developed them and implemented them for the benefit of other people. So we have a question from Jeff Vaughton on Twitter who asks, he says he'd love it if we spent some time on Core Intuition going over our recommended path for getting up to speed on web services. And I don't know if that means, I don't know exactly what that means, but I have a sense it just sort of means like, well, like if you're starting as somebody who has never tried to use a hosted web service, how do you make that leap? Is that sort of your read on that?
Yeah, that's how I read it too. And, you know, I can just tell you how I do things, and I don't know if that works for everyone, but I kind of settled into one basic way of doing server apps a long time ago. And I've just kind of stuck with it because I think you can get distracted by the new shiny web technologies. Like this, you know, you think Swift is like a big change. At least those big changes from Apple only happen once every 20 years. Like with the web community, especially the JavaScript community, but also server-side frameworks, this stuff changes all the time. And you can really waste a lot of time trying to be on the latest absolute best thing. So pick a language on the server that you're comfortable with and dive in, figure out what kind of the best practices are there, and just start building stuff. I think you can't go wrong if you have a Linux-like server somewhere and you're running, you know, PHP or Ruby. I like Ruby, Sinatra personally, Rails, some Python thing, and then MySQL or something like that. You can't go wrong if you pick a few core, like very widely used tools like that and just kind of dive in and start building stuff, build some JSON APIs, just start experimenting, feel that, how that, you know, works when you're hitting your iOS app and retrieving data and storing it. And depends on the app, but I think if you stick with some of those, like really just kind of standard, like thousands and thousands and thousands of other people have built web services like this before, you can't go too far wrong.
So I think I misunderstood the question, or we're interpreting it differently.
Oh, okay.
Because I thought Jeff meant, like, maybe I need to go back and look at it in context, but I thought he meant, like, say I want to get started, like, using services like Parse, like Amazon Web Services, you know, like these different things.
Oh, I was thinking more from a server. I guess my mind was in, you are building your own Parse. that's how I was thinking. So
right.
Maybe just consuming or hitting other APIs, or like Twitter API or Flickr API, things like that, maybe.
Yeah, I guess, like, if you think about it, for somebody who has never used these kinds of web services, and forgive us, Jeff, maybe we're now totally misunderstanding your question, but I think the question is good on behalf of, you know, the general developer audience. Like, somebody who's never, like, for you and I, Manton, even though I haven't used a ton of web services because of my experience using like APIs from blogging platforms and stuff like that, I have a pretty good understanding of, like, things that I imagine I take for granted, where other people would be like, what the heck? Like, you know, it's getting less and less common because so many people are familiar with the web. But, you know, when I got started with Mars Edit, I was like, XM what now? Like, XML? What's that? And I was like, coming into it from, you know, obviously I'd actually heard of it, but I was not familiar with the specifics of how it worked. And then, you know, things started using JSON, and I'm like, what's JSON? And you can follow the path back of, like, subtle expertise that you need to know about, all the way back to if you're just used to, like, making an iOS app that doesn't have any dependencies on web services, maybe you don't even know, like, how to use an SURL mm-hmm. request.
I see.
You know, like, there's kind of a lot, and again, forgive me if I'm totally misunderstanding this, but I kind of thought, like, let's just say, I took it as, like, let's just say you are a person who hasn't used web services, kind of like getting up to speed on which web services exist. Like, and maybe I kind of fall into this category because I don't know that I still really know, like, what Parse does or did. I kind of know you can store your data in it.
Well, don't learn now.
Don't learn now. But, you know, then there's all these other services, like, you know, Amazon's EC2, AWS stuff, and then there's Apple's iCloud stuff. And I don't know, I guess we probably should have asked him for some clarification, but maybe it's more fun just to go with our own interpretations.
Well, it's all kind of wrapped up together, too. I mean, yeah. Whether you're building the server stuff or not, I assume that's what he meant. But whether you are or not, you've still got to understand all the client stuff. You have to understand, at a minimum, for the modern API, JSON parsing and how you want to structure your iPhone app, but probably XML too. And if you go far enough back, maybe even some weird XML thing like XMRPC, which of course you're very familiar with.
Yeah. Well, I went back and read, I'm going to read it literally this time. I'd love it if you guys spent some time on CoreInt going over your recommended path for getting up to speed on web services. And this was in response to your blog article, since now you're on Twitter. Your blog article, Parse Shutting Down, where, you know, you talk about, and so maybe the reason you interpreted it this way is because you said you've always advocated for iOS developers to also be good at web services.
Right. Yeah.
So that's where your interpretation makes more sense than mine.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe that was still in the back of my head too. And I stand by that 100%. I feel like it's not to say anyone can build an iPhone app, but, like, there's so much value in more than just the iPhone app. Users expect sync. They expect apps to be connected. If you can build both the client and the server, I think you have an advantage. And because a lot of people can do that. I mean, you know, it's not a huge advantage because so many other people can do that too. But yeah, I think it's an important advantage to have. It allows you to build things that are different than what other people can build. And it's also allows you to build things much more quickly if you don't have to depend on, oh, I have an idea for a server thing, and now I got to go find someone to hire to do it, or farm it out, or find a friend that can help me. If you can do both, you can move much more quickly than you can even if you're working on a small team.
This is it. Now that I have the perspective right on this question, I'm interested again, and I won't go too long on this, of course, but thinking back to that reaction to Parse, a lot of people out on Twitter had the kind of, like, sarcastic reaction, like, well, it serves you right for depending on a web service. And other people were like, look, it's just not realistic to make your own, you know, it's hard enough to make an iPhone app on your own, let's say, especially as an indie, but even as a small business, it's hard enough to make the app without having to also think through this whole process of, you know, like Jeff is suggesting, like, how do I develop and implement my own web services layer? And so I think this is a very interesting balance. Like, on the one hand, I think maybe it's like so many things in development, like there's not an either, it's not like a easy across the board question to answer, but it's easy to imagine some web services needs being no brainer, do it yourself type solutions, and other ones being like, yeah, maybe you should really leave that to Microsoft or Amazon to handle.
Right. And there are some things that if you roll it yourself, you're actually not just taking on more work, but maybe having a worse user experience. So yeah. I think sync is a big thing that everyone thinks about. And it's kind of on my mind today because I was looking at the new Day One app, the new version 2 that they came out with. I've used Day One for a long time. I love it. It's kind of app that I wish I had come up with and like put all my effort into building something like that. They did a really great job. And in 2, they dropped like iCloud and Dropbox syncing for just their own sync, right? So they wrote their own web services. You can register and then you can sync everything. Panic has the same thing. Panic Sync. Omni has the same thing with a slightly different twist. But for a lot of people, you might say, well, that's another account that people have to register with. And maybe if you just need some basic sync, you should use CloudKit, because if you're iPhone only, if you don't have a web version or an Android version, might just be a smoother user experience for people.
Yeah. And some people, depending on the reputation of your company, are going to prefer the brand name that goes with their own selected, you know, persistence service. Like a lot of people out there, if they've never heard of your company before and you say, I'm going to store your photos for you, I'm going to put them on my server, maybe they'll be kind of like a little skeptical, but then you say, or I could just put them on your Facebook or on your, on your Dropbox.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then people are like, oh, Dropbox. Yeah, I know about that. Or same thing, I think with iCloud from Apple, you know, it's like, I'm just going to put this in your iCloud. It doesn't feel like the developer's service.
Yeah. And it's all about what are you trying to do? Like, let's say I'm building a photo service. Maybe Dropbox is a good fit for that, because a lot of people, myself included, like to have photos on Dropbox. But a photo service is not just like authentication, right? It's something kind of big. And so bigger the idea is, maybe, or the concept, like the more it actually makes sense for you to do it yourself, because the idea is big enough that it like requires an account. You know, it's not just like this simple little thing, a little authentication or a little sync thing. It's like something bigger than just an iPhone app. You know, maybe there's a web version. I kind of think about some of the tweet stuff I did in this category. It's like with my app Watermark, which I've been slowly trying to shut down and still haven't. The pitch was, I'm going to store not just all your own tweets, but every tweet from everybody you're following, like forever. That is a big thing to do. It's not something where, oh yeah, I'll just put that on Dropbox, or I'll just put that in, you know, CloudKit. Like that's like a whole service. That's a whole big thing by itself. And I think it's easier for that kind of idea to sell the customer on, yeah, you need an account because look what I'm doing. I'm doing all the stuff for you.
Yeah, right. And you're not going to get paid for it.
That's all another conversation business-wise with that product. But yeah, as an example of like the types of like a storage, it's not just sync, but it's like a storage infrastructure web service kind of thing. Like, I think you can make a argument that you should build and host that yourself if it's something that doesn't just easily piggyback on someone else's sync service.
Yeah, you know, the one other angle I'll mention, because I don't have as much experience as you with web services per se, but I do feel like it's important to have a little bit of just being comfortable with providing some kind of web service. And an example of the kinds of things that I've done that have just made me feel kind of better about better about the long-term user experience. Here's an example. Like, I have some links in my apps that that link to like WordPress or Blogger or something, and they have to like build into them like the right parameters and stuff to get you to the right spot to sign up for a new blog. And the other angle of this was I wanted to get some credit for like coming from me if like it became significant enough, and I wanted them to know like, hey, I'm sending you guys some customers. So instead of having a link from the app, I have a link to my site that just has like a simple script running back there that redirects to the correct URL. And I sort of built this as a generic thing on my site so that there's like a mechanism where I can redirect things in perpetuity. And then I have the opportunity to go in there and change it. And I think the reason I mentioned this example is because it's like the utmost simple example of something, but it's still, you know, on some level, a quote unquote web service. It took was having a server that could run some scripting language. I used PHP because it's ubiquitous, and, you know, I have to keep it up. But the payback for that is I get this like intermediary opportunity to keep things working and for the long term. And I get the opportunity to, you know, tweak it if I need to.
Yeah. And you're decoupling kind of your app from the eventual URL the user's going to, which you can go overboard with this. I don't think you should do this all the time, but I think there is value in finding places where you don't want that kind of thing like hard coded in your app completely. And anytime you can decouple some of that, I think it's kind of handy.
Yeah, like another example that comes to mind is something I meant to do for a long time, and actually some of my competitors did do it in the crossword puzzle realm, which is, you know, a lot of these crossword apps, like mine included, they have like URLs to well-known sources of crossword puzzles. And basically the innovation was like implemented as a caching server, so that you're not like hammering somebody else's site just to get the puzzles. Of course, there's weird little copyright issues there, but maybe that's why I never ended up doing it. But that's an example where if you have something that you depend on the web for and it's out of your control, it might be a good idea to consider putting a little trampoline that is in your control. Maybe that's like something like a redirector, like I mentioned, or maybe it's just something that updates from time to time, like a scraping template. Let's say you scrape a website somewhere. Maybe you use your indirect site to like provide a scraping recipe. Using your own, I think like it's hard for me to imagine any business that sells software that doesn't need to have a permanent, reliable up web server that they can choose to host things that make sense as they go forward. And I think picking anything that you can imagine benefiting from and then using that as your start into web, quote unquote, web services is probably a good approach. And I agree with Manton. Use the simplest, most kind of time-tested technologies you can. There's nothing wrong with using PHP if you get the job done, you know? And likewise, MySQL, et cetera. So one thing, Manton, maybe we could wrap up on this, because this is one thing I think from the perspective of somebody like Jeff trying to get their head around writing their own web services, something that would have me be paranoid would be the whole question of authentication. And is that something that you have any tips about? Like, are there off-the-shelf packages that you'd would recommend installing for different languages, or do you have gotchas to warn people off of?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that is something it's like you want to be careful. I have evolved into thinking about this in a couple ways. One is that for a lot of my apps, I just kind of handed off authentication to like Twitter or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I was never storing like passwords exactly. You know, you sort of like auth tokens and that kind of thing instead, and you let another service kind of deal with the hard part, I guess. In my latest app, and actually in another one of my apps, SearchPath, I didn't want to have passwords. I didn't want passwords, like, they suck, right? You can't remember them. You got to change them. Like, there's all sorts of problems. And so instead, if someone needed to log in, you just enter your email address and then it just sends you an email link and you click it and you're logged in. And then you stayed logged in for a long time. And I'm doing that in my new app too. And I love it. I hope it continues to work. It's not perfect because it's most services have a password and like a username and password. And so some users might not be kind of used to it. And, you know, one of my beta testers was like, are you sure you want to do this? You know, like, good luck with it, kind of. Like, hope it works out. But, like, some people might not like it. And it makes some things more difficult. Like, if you log in with the iPhone app and you don't have a password, what do you do? And my answer to that is I have, like, auth tokens that you can kind of, per app, you can register and put in there, kind of like Google has, kind of like some other people do. And then I also have where, you can just get a quick email link to your phone, and it has a URL that goes right into the app with a URL, you know, handler and logs you in. So that's it's kind of a complicated answer, but I've been trying to go that way. I've been trying to go where you register with the email address. I send you an email to verify that it's actually yours. And then from then on, you always sign in with your email address and that's all you need. And I like the simplicity of that, not having to deal with passwords on the server. It's not perfect because you have to have an email, but that's the way I'm going, and I'm hoping it works well for my new app.
Yeah, I wonder if it doesn't work well. I think there's still some value in preserving that email authentication workflow, because when you, for example, email somebody their lost password, them like copying and pasting that into the web service is no better than... Well, I guess usually when you do that, you're not sending them the password. You're sending them like a reset. But
right.
That process, going through that process is really no better than just logging them in.
Well, and that's the thing. From a security standpoint, I don't think a password is any more secure than what I'm doing. And in fact, it's worse most of the time because people have terrible passwords. Like, you can't have a terrible password on my service because there is no password. And the process on the server is not very much code. It's like, you say, I want to get a sign in. You know, I want to sign in, you put your email address in, and I just have a little temporary thing on the server.
Yeah.
I use Redis for this kind of thing where it's like all memory and fast and I can expire it. And it creates this random long, you know, auth token basically, and just, you know, uses that to sign in, and then it, you know, expires, or, you know, I mean, it's like, it's fairly easy to handle. And I think it's just as secure, if not more secure than a traditional password method.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Well, the long story short from Manton, as usual, is don't do it any normal way. Do it some new Manton way. You know, this is what you say. Use all the old boring technology, except use fancy new email passwords.
Yeah, you know, I'd love some feedback from listeners if what I said makes any sense also, and how they feel about it. But I do feel like passwords are a total pain for most people. I mean, how many of us have like one password installed? And, you know, just, and even that helps a little bit, but it's like just the fact that you need tools just to manage all this stuff. Most users cannot deal with this. Most normal people have one password that they share between most everything. It's not secure.
Yeah.
And then they're always frustrated when a site like says like, your password's not secure enough, please add more crazy punctuation. And it's like, it's a pain. And so yeah, my solution has one drawback, and that it does require you receiving an email, but the rest is totally fast and smooth. You don't have to type anything weird in. So,
well, that sounds like a good amount of advice to try to digest for one show. And everybody can let us know exactly the many ways that we misunderstood the question and what we need to hit on our next convoluted response to the similar subject. And then we'll catch up with that. As always, of course, you know, if you do want to get in touch with us with any of this kind of feedback, you can hit us up on the Slack. We are pretty much, you know, always there. It's chat.corent.org. You can email us, feedback@corent.org, and you can tweet at us @corent.
Great. It's good talking to you this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. Talk to you next week.